This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Here we go. As Robin just called it off the air, it's Tuesdays with Bob.
Tuesdays with Bob. We killed the opening monologue already.
We got the Duggars to talk about today. We got some Rex Herrmann to talk about today. We're going to start with the Duggars. A man allegedly confessed before a lawyer was anywhere near him. The state of Florida has felony charges ready. The state of Arkansas has its own case building separately. And a defense attorney handling it just told the media his client wants to be treated fairly. Fair is a fine goal. But what the audience wants to know is what a defense actually looks like when the evidence appears, like when you maybe admitted to this on a phone call and it's stacked against you before the first hearing even starts. Joining us to help us break this down, it's Tuesdays with Bob. Bob Motta, defense attorney. Host of the podcast.
Tuesdays with Bob.
Defense Rights. We'll make a jingle for you. It's Tuesdays with Bob.
Yeah. What about Bob?
Let's start here with the Duggars. This is not going to be an easy one to walk into out of the gate. If in fact he did allegedly confess over the phone to Joseph, Dad's having this conversation with Joseph, and Joseph's saying, "Yeah, I did it, but I'm asking for forgiveness." Okay, it's there once done, and then once with an officer on the line. How damning is that going into a case if you're trying to defend somebody?
Pretty damning, T.
And it's funny, Bob, because normally I'm always waiting for the reverse angle. You know, it doesn't really count, you know, and you don't really know them, and it was coerced, you know, but when Bob said, it's not good.
Yeah, dude, no, this is not a good situation. The bigger problem from them, you know, I think we talked about last week a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, you can potentially attack on the over here, you know, mm-hmm. when he makes the call. But in terms of the confession to a non-law enforcement, like you can't come at him with Mirandizing. Fourth Amendment isn't a thing because private citizens can't violate mm-hmm. your Fourth Amendment. That's the government. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's the problem with it from the perspective of trying to attack the confessions, you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? So, I mean, look, again, defense attorneying isn't scumbaggery, slippery, trying mm-hmm. to get guilty people off. You're trying to make sure that your client gets a fair trial.
Right.
You're trying to make sure that the cops did their job on the up and up. Same with the prosecutor. And you're trying to make sure that your client understands his rights or her rights. And if you do all those things and they have the evidence, they're going to be convicted if they don't take a plea. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, and that's where this thing really lay. I think because we all are in true crime and we're covering active cases, it becomes kind of pushed to the side the concept that really the reality of the situation is that 90%+ of cases are pled out.
Sure.
Like, it's very rare for things to go to trial. So, and when you have evidence like this, I mean, if Duggar walked into our office, first of all, and I know we're going to get to the next question, but you know, which I'll wait. I'm usually slipping into the next questions in an answer. I'm going to try to do better, Tony.
I do it all the time.
Yeah, hard, because I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, go
but
for it.
Look, you know, I'm sitting down with my client. I'm hearing, you know, his version. In this case, I'm like, okay, did you talk to anybody? It's always one of the first three questions I ask. Did you talk to the cops? Did you make a statement? Okay, what? What did you say? I can't remember. Well, try. Because, you know, you're all I have until I get discovery, you know. And for my purposes, it doesn't really matter on an initial consult. I'm just trying to give them an understanding what the charges are, what the potential penalties are. And, you know, without having the discovery, I don't know the full story yet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm kind of beholden to my client, whatever they're telling me. And, you know, I take it with a grain of salt. I understand that most of my clients come in and say, I didn't do this shit. And I'm like, okay, you know, so that question of whether or not they talk to anybody is an important one. And then, you know, I really do press them to try to get as much as I can from them on what they said and to who it was made to, that statement. matters quite a bit, as it does here. But, you know, I mean, they'll try to attack the over here, I'm sure.
Sure.
You know, because, like, the approach is you're not pleading out immediately, right? You've got to get the discovery. You're not doing the job. You're just pleading, like, you're screwed, dude. Like, sorry, you made the statement. You might as well plead you out right away. I'm right. sure there's attorneys out there that do that, but they're not very good attorneys. So yeah. you got to wait till the discovery comes in. You look at it. You say, all right, look, you know, I've looked at it. It looks like they went and got this warrant. It looks like they're basing it on the CAC interview. And they've got enough to get this thing in. This thing's not going to get suppressed. I'm not going to file frivolous motions just to file it. There's got to be grounds for me to try to attack it. And if that's not the case, then we're looking at it. We're going through the rest of the evidence. And ultimately, you know, in a situation like this, I consider the confessions or the statements just to be corroborative.
Yeah.
Because ultimately the victim's going to testify.
Yeah.
So this isn't a situation where you've just got a young victim testifying. You now have the alleged perpetrator admitting to it on two different occasions, once in an over here and then once to an individual, a private citizen. So it's tough, man.
Yeah. So Bob, I got a really gross question, and I apologize for anyone.
I'm leaving.
Watch your wording. We're on YouTube.
I am. That's why I'm going to take my time and try to frame it right. And it's only because I didn't work these cases inside the bureau, and I don't know the law much better, hugely much better than I do. I'm curious about this. Because we covered so much of Epstein stuff, and I read Ginny's book, and also we cover cases like Maddie Soto, and you remove the murder aspect of that, but just what Stephen Stearns did to her. And then I read the charges that Joseph's accused of. We have overclothing. Is there a difference in the law between overclothing accusatory, doing horrendous things to children, and no clothing? I know it's a granular thing, but I'm just curious whether they might be able to get off on something or lessen something because of that, as I just don't know the law on that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is. And it, like, what it boils down to, like, just simply put, is it's a different level of felony.
Is it?
So, yeah. Like, if there's penetration of, you know,
that's the more crash way I wanted to. Yeah. I was curious
about. Yeah. I mean, but that, I mean, that's actually the legal term.
Right.
But that, you know, that changes the game. You know,
because the penalty of this seems still was extremely steep, which I loved seeing. I was just wondering if it could get even steeper if we discover more. I guess that's what I was getting at.
Yes, it can get steeper.
Is anyone surprised that that Joseph just flat out came out and said this on the phone call with the dad? I mean, that to me, I thought was, I don't know, I'm kind of surprised and I'm kind of not. I guess you kind of got to look at it from the perspective of where Joseph might have been at that moment in time, where he's conditioned, where most things get handled insularly within the Duggar, you know, cult. And then things don't necessarily reach the law. Do you think he had zero sense in him that there might be an officer on the other line hearing this when he's repeating it again for a second time, or was he just that completely clueless? And if he's that clueless, I'm wondering why he might have been that clueless. Was this a person that he trusted to a degree that that he wouldn't have contemplated that would bring the law after him?
I mean, I would have to think so.
Yeah,
I would have to think so. I you know, I gave an example of an overhear of one of my clients back in the day. And, you know, I mean, it was the baby mama, you know, when the outcry happened, baby mama was obviously furious and upset and immediately went to law enforcement. And they said, okay, at this point we've got a very, very young child still, but the allegations are coming from 7 years previous. We're going to want more. You know, because at the end of the day, if they're going to take it to trial and you've got the child victim is really your best evidence, you're going to try to get more if you're law enforcement. And typically this is what they'll do. You know, they'll say, all right, well, we're going to ask for an overhear warrant. And you're going to have to talk to him, and you've got to get, you've got to try to get him to admit it on the phone call. So, I mean, really they're employing that person as an agent, you know, which is why they have to go get the warrant, you know, so, and it's important for the cases typically.
Yeah.
Well, so you want, so I would assume that this wasn't a stranger. You know, I'm assuming that this is someone that felt, you know, he felt at least comfortable enough. Cause that's a big thing to tell somebody.
But you know what I mean? And Tony, to your point, you know, we talked about this the other day. He is so, they are so, and I'm going to use the word groomed into this religion. Remember that big word we were using yesterday? By admitting, you get restoration. As long as you're talking to someone who he feels can restore himself, so you confess and you're restored. Restoration means so much more to them than innocent, it seems, because of that religion compared to law. I mean, it's really pretty profound. And Bob, I'm curious, have you seen any other group or cult that seems to elevate their cult law above actual legal law as much as this group seems to be?
I mean, yeah, I've seen, obviously, I think every kind of cult that's been exposed criminally, like in the last 15, 20 years, you see that all the time, right? I mean, it's, they just, and I don't know if they rely on this concept that they're, you know, they're outside of the boundaries of the law because it's religion, you know, and, and I think that they're kind of confusing what, you know, the freedom of religion clause means, you know, and that's what are like you don't get to turn around and say, okay, well, you know, our religion allows murder, but, you know, unfortunately for them, there's a statute that predates that religion, because the concept of the Constitution is that the government can't make any law that infringes upon that right. Okay. So, like, meaning it's going to be, it's ex post facto. So they start a religion, and, you know, one of the things they do is, you know, they drink Kool-Aid standing on their head, waiting for the mothership to land. And, you know, the government's like, you know what? I cannot stand watching people drinking Kool-Aid, like, standing on their head. The shit's coming out of their nose. It's disgusting.
It's weird.
We're going to pass some legislation strictly banning that. Like, that kind of thing, you've got an argument, you know, a constitutional argument. But you know, obviously, SA statutes are in place and have been for a very long time. You're not going to be able to escape being tried under a state or federal law based on religion, for the most part, you know, and it's like you used to see it more. Oddly enough, I had a really, when I was in law school all those many years ago, every year we like, so the 1Ls, the first years, would all, every one of them would have to prepare an appellate brief, and then we'd do oral arguments. It was a competition. And then ultimately, you know, it was like bracket play. You'd make it in the final two. So our interesting fact pattern was that it was a child whose parents were, oh God, what is the religion? They don't celebrate holidays and birthdays. Starts with an M.
Jehovah's Witness?
Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. My name is like that growing up.
Okay, so one of the other tenets of that religion is that they can't have other people's blood. It's like, like, so blood transfusions are wholly
big no-no,
rejected in their religion. And so this kid, so the fact pattern was this. Okay, you've got parents, you've got a 16-year-old kid. He's got this disease where they can cure it, where if they don't do this particular surgery, which they're going to need to transfuse blood during the surgery. If they don't do that, then he's going to lose his ability to be able to walk. It's not as severe as he's going to die. So it was clever the way that they made it, where it would just, he'd lose his ability to be able to walk.
That's all.
So that's all. Big deal, right? So like the two issues for us were mature minor doctrine. Okay. Like, was that child mature enough as a 16-year-old to make their own medical decisions. And then the other one was this tug of war between the First Amendment and the right of religion. And it's their belief. It's their firm belief. So we had to argue it out, you know, and there wasn't any, I mean, there's this case called Yoder, which is a Supreme Court case that really digs deep into the First Amendment, but it was a fascinating exercise. And it kind of gets to the heart of what I think the mindset of a lot of these cult leaders and the followers subscribe to, you know, and it's just this thing where they're living off grid, you know, they're living in their own kind of commune. They have their own set of rules. They do things differently. They don't feel as if they're a part of regular society. You know, I mean, yes, there's probably aspects of it where they incorporate because they need to make money. You know what I mean? Like money's always the thing. Money is where they.
And that's what's so interesting about these guys is that they are not. I mean, you have the Amish, which are more off grid than IBLP is.
Yeah.
And yet they seem so. Even though they keep having these examples in the same family of Josh and now Joseph, that they fear that umbrella of that protection of their religion more than they fear the law, which has actually bit them in the ass a lot more than anything else has. And yet they still keep coming back to it. It's really mind bending.
I think that their thing is, you know, God's going to make it okay. You know, if they're operating in according to their tenets under the word of God, as they understand it to be, and you know, what you always get with these cult leaders is that, you know, they got the bat phone to God. Right.
Yeah.
You know, God's communicating with them directly. And so, you know, I mean, if you get people to the point where they're brainwashed enough or their faith is so deep in that person that they actually do believe that there's some kind of Messiah, you know, and that they do believe that this person is communicating directly with God. I mean, how do you overcome that in terms of you've got to unbrainwash them? You've got to.
I mean, it's almost like a toxic glass half full mentality, where it's beyond just like, well, let's try and make the positive out of this, because some things there's just no positive to be had, and Jim Bob's letter to Joseph in prison was basically toxic positivity.
Yeah.
You've done some very horrible things, or however he worded it.
Choices.
But he's going to use it, but you're going to be able to minister to those behind bars and spread the word. It's like, what? Let me get ministered to by the guy that was doing these things allegedly to a kid. Like, let me just, this is the person I want to hear the word of the Lord from. But they seem to not understand the context that sticks to them and how vile and disgusting they look. They always view themselves as pure as long as they've made their peace. It doesn't matter that nobody's made peace with them. As long as they've made their peace with God, well, then everybody else should just be, you know, they should just be in fine light going forward. And that's the real sickness, I think, of cults and of this specific family.
See, here's where it's fascinating to me. And here was where I would love to see just massive psychological examinations taking place with these cult leaders.
Yeah.
To where you can figure out, I mean, are they either psychotic in that they think that they're communicating with God? I mean, do they actually think that that is happening, or is it all just a big ruse?
Well, I mean, there's plenty of religions that are not this extreme that think they're communicating with God and, you know, and walk around. Yeah.
Let me clarify. I'm not talking about praying. I'm talking about back and forth. All right.
That's only Lori Daybell. Lori Daybell believed that. And Chad.
A lot of them do.
But this group, you know, I haven't read anything that said that this group believed that. They just have an interpretation of the Bible that what they did was, again, I'm not the expert, from what I keep consuming every day of this of my life so far, is they've handpicked aspects of it that allowed the founder to rationalize his control he wanted to have over people for top cover of his own abhorrent behavior. I've seen this in other things, whether it's law or politics. Nation states do the same thing, mm-hmm. where you'll cherry pick stuff that is a doctrine that people will adopt in mass, like religion, and they'll cherry pick their stuff to rationalize your own abhorrent behavior, and you form people and groups around it. And that's what's happened here. And then you keep perpetuating that, but as common sense as it seems to us, when you are that needy of acceptance and being valued, and then you get in that collective group mentality, I'm telling you, I mean, yeah. if anyone wants to see the power of a group mentality, you can do it on YouTube. You go to YouTube and you go to Candid Camera Elevator Experiment. And you can see the power of the group mentality, social pressure, and they get the old Candid Camera with Alan Fun. Those of us that are old remember this. You would get three or four people in an elevator, and if one person turns to the back,
right,
everyone else is start turning around, beard like, because you just want to conform to that group. And so that's what happens in groups like this, where they have this belief system that restoration, all you have to do is confess. And you confess, and again, the wording, they don't have words like sexual sins. They call them moral failures.
Yeah.
Wording is everything, right?
It is. I mean, you'll notice the blow.
You'll notice that same sort of approach. IBLP is them, but I was just watching, and there's a new doc coming out on Netflix about the FLDS and Bateman. But I was watching the earlier one that it's like part two to it, basically. I forget what it's called. It's like, you know, pray, obey, something of that nature. But they operate the same sort of way, where you get these people that come out of this cult at whatever teenage year or 20 something. They don't have words to describe what happened to them. That's right. Part of how they hold everything in. That's part of how they people can't talk about it. They don't have the words to do it. They don't exist in their vernacular. And if you purposely keep people away from being able to describe what has been done to you, and the only things that exist are some sort of godly term or some sort of thing that tampers it down, doesn't make it quite as bad, or even in some cases, look at Warren Jeffs, it's like godliness. They're convincing people this is what the Lord wants, is for me to do these horrible things to you as a child. You then get people defining it very differently depending on how you framed it.
It is no mystery. Religion. And Marx said it many, 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 many years ago. It's an opiate of the people. It's used to control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Flat out. And that's not to say that people that have faith, good on you. You know, sure. I'm all about that. That's a great thing. Yeah. But in terms of the mechanics of religion, mm-hmm. you know, Tony, to that thing that you're talking about, you simply have to make it, that it's a rule within that religion.
Yeah.
You know, if certain things are happening, well, you're not going to say, oh, well, we're going to keep quiet because we don't want to get in trouble with law enforcement. You're framing it in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Right.
It's coming down from the hand of God.
Yeah.
That this is what we've been taught to do. Now, the rest of society might not accept this as normal, but, mm-hmm. you know, this is what we know. And if he is your fearless leader, this came down straight from the big guy.
Especially when you assimilate, because it's not even that you know, I'm talking to God, like we were talking earlier. They identify like the leader, Gothard, with God. They identify the father of the family with God. Like they're on that level with God. Right. So if it's as good as coming from God, basically, if dad says it or the leader of the cult says it, that's just as good as God. It doesn't even have to come down. It's like if they decided it, if this came to his brain, well, it came to him from God. So it's just as good. And that's how they're able to kind of make this even less less ridiculous than it already is.
And we forgot, I'm sorry, because the one aspect that we forgot to talk about in this, in the last couple sessions on this and today too, that I really want to emphasize, this religion, this IBLP, they victim blame the women for enticing the men.
Mm-hmm.
That was, so we haven't even covered that aspect of it yet. So no matter if a male has a moral failing, they blame the woman for being too enticing. That's why I have to wear the clothing they do. So that's how they get around. Again, we're talking about that reframing and not having definitions for things. So when these, when the poor men are susceptible and have a moral failing, they try to identify the woman that made it happen and they chastise her.
Yeah, well, that's
a lot of religion.
I got news for you, Robin. That's not just in religion, man. I mean,
I know.
Sadly, in society, where women are you know, who are victims, who are then blamed because of their the clothing that they wore, they were asking for it. It's it's sick. You know, sick. I mean, like that concept is disgusting. You know, but I want to jump back. That thing that you were talking about, Tony.
Yeah.
I mean, that Messiah complex. Whether it was I had a dream. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter in terms of reaching that level where you are seen as the Messiah at the level, that same level, maybe like one notch below God. It's because at some point they've said that they've had communication with the Lord. That has happened at some point. They may not be talking about, he may not be saying, oh, well, you know, God gave me a call last night and this is what he said. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not like that.
It's
to kind of establish yourself as that you're the one, you're the chosen one, you have to have had some kind of communication.
They make it very palatable for their followers to believe. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on what's going on with Joseph Duggar. There's more to talk about in this case.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.